You are listening to a sermon by Robert Daum, recorded on Sunday, November 3, 2013, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thank you, Evan and Andre. I'm delighted to be here with you all. Having an auditor in the class with whom to learn is really a pleasure for the instructor as well. In many ways, it reminds me as a teacher of something that many of us know who are teachers, of the wisdom that is part of my own tradition. When we say in my tradition that we're going to study a particular unit of material in a class, we don't say, the teacher doesn't say, today I'm going to teach you such and such, or speaking to another person, in my class today I'm going to teach them this, but rather what we say in my tradition is, today I'm going to learn this with you. We're going to learn this text. And in many ways, the learning is the fruit of what will happen in our conversation afterwards. So I'll speak for a little while, and then I'll sit and join you in the discussion to which I'm looking forward. When I arrived here, after having corrected my GPS to indicate that my destination was West 11th Avenue and not West 4th Avenue, you can tell when I was hesitating about the cross street of the synagogue I belong to. Directions are not my thing. But there was this reassuring voice on my GPS that said, you have arrived at your destination, which isn't something that happens, I find, with the same, or at least I don't experience the same degree of confidence when I arrive at what I think is an interesting insight about a passage within the Bible. Sometimes when I do the introductory lecture in the Arts 1 program at UBC in one of the two sections, which I've had the privilege of doing over the last number of years, I ask the students what the Bible says about this or that issue. And then I take the Bible and I say, well, then let's find out what the Bible says. And I take the microphone and I put it on the book. And then I wait. And the reason I do that is, I hope, clear that the Bible doesn't say anything about anything. We give voice to the text. And we've been giving voice to this text in all kinds of ways for a very long time. There's a wonderful new book out. There are many wonderful new books out about the Bible. One in particular that I really like is one of the three books that I've assigned to the group. In the class on Genesis, and it's by a wonderful scholar at Berkeley named Ronald Hendel. It's called Genesis, a Biography. And it's a marvelous book because it deals with what Hendel refers to as the afterlife of Genesis. Not just the life of Genesis in terms of its composition over about a 1,000-year period. Well, the Bible, at any rate, in Genesis, was reworked for many, many centuries. But also the afterlife, that is, its interpretative life, since it more or less stabilized as a text. And the notion of a book having a life and an afterlife, the period of its production, and then the period of its interpretation, comes from a teaching of Walter Benjamin, a wonderful literary critic and thinker, who also devoted a lot of attention to speculating about translation and about the fact that translation is a betrayal of both the text one is translating and the text that one is creating. In a way, what both Hendel's application of the idea of a text having an afterlife as distinct from a life, and Benjamin's notion of a text having a life and an afterlife, as well as his observation that translation is a kind of double betrayal, what it gets at is the extent to which we are distanced from this text, not only from major moments in its afterlife, as earlier generations of readers approached it in ways very different from earlier or later generations of readers, but also very different from the approaches by those who were alive at the time of its coming into being over the course of many centuries in antiquity. But it also draws our attention to the extent to which it's almost impossible for us, if not impossible for us, to actually read past or around or through these very significant moments in the text's afterlife, each of which has created a whole series of layers that get between us and the text. Now, if we think what we're trying to do is get to the text itself, that's probably illusory. We probably can't do that. But we should pay attention to the layers in between us and the text so that we can at least understand both what it is that is affecting our interpretations, what we bring to the text, what we bring before we even look at the text, but also so that we can pay closer attention to the text at the other end of that series of layers. I remember when I went to the Louvre for the first time, and I was so excited about seeing the Mona Lisa. I didn't have a lot of time, so I was running down the halls, which you aren't supposed to do. And I got to the place where the Mona Lisa was, and as some of you can relate, I was really quite disappointed. Not just because it wasn't so as impressive as I thought it would be, but also because not that I could do better, mind you, but that it was just so far away. It was, I couldn't get near it. It was at the end of this tunnel of glass. I think what's important about that that analogy for me is the extent to which we're not aware of the tunnel of glass between us and this text. Ronald Hendel, in his wonderful book, draws a kind of a sketch of the series of moves between the time, more or less, when the Bible, when Genesis at least, was consolidated, sometime in the century or two, probably, before the time of Jesus. But the text continued to be reworked for several centuries afterwards, and we have evidence from the Dead Sea Scrolls that there were competing versions of the biblical texts. And there wasn't, or at least if there was, we can't really know what might have been the original text, and maybe there even wasn't an original version of these texts. So different are the versions that we have in ancient manuscripts, but also, and perhaps more profoundly, these texts that circulated, many of them, most of them, orally, in many cultural contexts, even the parts that were originally written down rather than originally having been created orally, were part of a culture in which we had at least two competing traditions about what one was supposed to do when one was learning or relearning or reperforming a text in community with others. One approach was to be as faithful as possible to the version that one had heard from one's own teacher or teachers, thereby repeating more or less verbatim what one had received. But another practice was to do something very different, to perform or reperform the text and in a new context and apply it to a new situation and to bring one's own insights to it, both as a display of the freedom and of the responsibility as interpreter, but also to set an example that makes a clear point about the difference between the text that one had received and what one thinks it means at any given moment. Now, in the course of our history of reading this book, Hendel and others have pointed to the fact that for a very long time, Hendel suggests about 1,000 years, we were caught in what he refers to as a kind of figural interpretative mode. By that, he means that we read the text as operating at more than one level. That is, there's the level of the text that we have, the verses you just read. But beneath it, there is another kind of hidden text. The two dominant schools or modes of what that other hidden text or hidden meaning was, Handel suggests, was one of them was a kind of apocalyptic mode. That is, that the text hinted at a time beyond our own time, that the world would somehow return to its Edenic state. We would go back to Eden in some way, which made Genesis a particularly rich source for discovering hints of the time that was to come. And that was quite a dominant interpretative strategy for a very long time. Another figural approach, that is, seeing the text as having both a manifest layer and having a hidden or deeper layer, pointed not at a deeper meaning in terms of another time beyond ours, but of a deeper meaning in terms of another place beyond ours. That referred to a whole range of observations or speculations about another world that we couldn't see, in that was present at all times, but it was invisible to us. Philo is probably the most famous ancient interpreter who read biblical texts as hinting at this invisible world beyond us. He drew his ideas, as a number of scholars have argued over the years, from Plato, this idea that there are eternal forms, and then we can only see the figures before us, but that behind them is something much deeper and more profound. And Philo used this kind of approach as a way of reconciling the distance between himself, his approach to the world, and the text in front of him. This became a very important technique for those who were familiar with Greek thought, faced with a canonical textual tradition like the works of Homer, which seemed to be describing a world of gods acting like, spoiled children, not worth worshiping, really, because of all the nonsense they were getting up to. And so a certain kind of reading of this canonical text that had great value for the culture emerged, reading it as symbolic of something deeper, as an allegory. And so in that way, one could read references to biblical characters as signifying other figures later in history, of words that were masking layers beneath those words, which had truths that could somehow be reconciled with philosophical or scientific knowledge as time went on. You can see the value in this kind of approach. If the text always means what it says on the surface, but also might be pointing in directions beneath the text or behind the text, that's a way of making the text always relevant, always speak to us in some way. It also underscores the text's cryptic or enigmatic quality, which invites interpretation. It also allows for the possibility of reconciling one's faith commitments about the nature of this text as somehow being perfect and complete and not requiring that one go outside of it in order to discover deep truths. And it also helps one to reconcile another deeply held principle, all of which you can see reflected in that passage from Hebrews that Evan read a little while ago, that is, that the text is somehow divine in origin. Those four characteristics of the Bible and of Genesis as a part of it, that it is fundamentally cryptic, that it is profoundly always relevant, that it is somehow perfect and complete, and that it is also divine in origin, those commitments, widely held by many, started to crack. They started to loosen and give way in the context of the Renaissance, of scientific discoveries, and of the rediscovery of scientific works as they were translated through from Greek into Arabic and Latin and so on, as they made their way into the works of thinkers who were brought up in their religious traditions, but were now rediscovering texts that had been composed by philosophers and scientists centuries ago that created profound problems for persons who saw themselves as being persons of great faith on the one hand, and also persons with a rational faculty capable of understanding the world. So, for example, how does one reconcile a text that seems to describe a world created in 6 days? How does one reconcile a reference in Genesis to the two great lights, the sun and the moon, which seems to suggest, as some interpreters in the Middle Ages found quite troubling, that the stars and the planets were smaller than the moon? They knew scientifically that that didn't make sense. So how did they reconcile that? They had constantly to adjust themselves to the text by finding ways to read it as signifying something beyond what was at the surface. This idea of reading the text, the Bible, literally is actually a relatively new approach. In many ways, as some scholars have suggested, it actually is a kind of forgetting of many of the approaches taken to the biblical text over the centuries. And I'd like to just show a few examples before I pause for discussion. Examples of the ways in which the complexity of the text is apparent if we have some of the tools that would have been in the hands of readers a long, long time ago. Now, some of those tools are more apparent if one has can read it in Hebrew. There's a difference between reading it in Hebrew or reading it in Greek or reading it in any language. But nevertheless, many of these characteristics can still be seen in English. The first is to look at the very beginning of the text. And what we discover in your handout in Genesis 1 is that this isn't the only creation story here. Now, that might not seem problematic, but if you look at this creation story and compare it to the other creation stories, you find some very dramatic, some profound differences, which are going to be troubling if one believes that the text, being divine in origin and being perfect, if that is what one brings to it, is also somehow consistent, that it is non-contradictory. But the problem is that there are all kinds of apparent contradictions. Namely, we have not only different names for God, but we have very different narratives of the creation, which do stand in contrast with each other on the surface, quite profoundly so. The sequence of creation in Genesis 1 is quite different from the sequence of creation that we get in Genesis 2:4 on. It's a very different order. So we have formless and void sort of essence or matter, darkness covering the face of the deep, a wind of God, and then all these various things are created, and then we get people. Woman is created after the animals. If we look at Genesis 2, it's a very different story. First of all, in Genesis 1, we have this seemingly undifferentiated in terms of gender, this being, this earth creature, who's somehow male and female, which ancient interpreters already in by the 2nd or 3rd century CE or AD were understanding as being somehow an androgyne combining both the gender identity of male and female. And then in Genesis 2, we have what looks like woman created out of man, but which some readers suggest is actually an undifferentiated being out of which the first differentiated being is created, namely woman as the first undifferentiated being. So it's a very murky problem because we have two very different stories about the sequence. We also have very different names for the deity used. There are some other problems that we discover if we look at the various creation stories scattered through the Bible, not just in Genesis. The book of Job has a creation myth, and Proverbs has a creation myth. We find scattered throughout the Bible references to other creation stories. So what we want to know is, what would an early teacher or reader or listener to this text who was aware of the culture in which he or she lived have heard as resonances in the text that we're not aware of? And I want to draw your attention to just a couple very quickly. One of them is in verse 2, and it's of Genesis 1, which is masked in the translation, but I want to just draw your attention to what's there in Hebrew. It says that the earth was a formless void and darkness covered the face of the deep. The. Now that definite article, the, is not there in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, it's just tahom. It's just tahom. It just says deep. Now what is tahom? So in other words, the Hebrew says something like over the face of tahom. So face sounds anthropomorphic. Right? I've got a face. So what might Tahom have resonated with? Well, in Mesopotamia, we have a deity named Tiamat. And it looks like and there are other references to gods of the sea and of the mountains and of the sky and so on and so forth. So what might be beneath this is a reference to an assertion of this creation by this particular deity as one which is ordering the chaotic worlds in which other deities and other cosmic forces were powerful and threatening in some way. But this deity is hovering over the face of the god of the sea, as it were, the watery chaos, Tiamat. Okay? This idea that this particular creation narrative, which we attribute to a priestly scribal school or cohort in roughly the 6th century BCE, is also exercising or asserting its point of view about the world being a world in which there's only one God, if not only one God, at least only one God who is in control or more powerful than the other cosmic forces. We can see this also in the reference to the lights that were created. It's a little bit later, not right here in this part that you've got on here, but the two great lights, the great light meaning the what we understand to be the sun, and what we understand to be the moon. It doesn't refer to them as sun and moon, even though those words were available, and even though those words are used elsewhere. In other words, it doesn't say Shemesh, which is sun, and it doesn't say Yareach, which would have been an easily available word for moon. It says the two great lights. And some scholars suggest that one of the reasons for not naming them is because it doesn't want to give further credence to or support to the idea of the sun god, Shamash, and Yirach, the moon god, of neighboring peoples. So it's calling them big light, little light, so as to naturalize them, to disempower them in some way, right? To take them down. So we can see that same characteristic of so perhaps more directly having God over the face of Tiamat, the cosmic force of the sea, right? Taming that cosmic force. And also a more subtle way of taking down the cosmic forces of the sun god and the moon god, worshipped by neighboring peoples, including people in the same community, of course. By referring to the sun and the moon, not by their cosmic deity names, but just big light, lesser light. the same, we have a similar, you can see a kind of push and pull between a back and forth, a tug of war between competing theologies, competing cultural models of the way the world works. We can see it as well manifested in our own day in translation choices around this wind of God. In verse 2, some Bible translations in English will say wind of God with an uppercase W. There are no uppercase letters in biblical Hebrew. And so that's a translator's choice to make it uppercase or lowercase. This one makes it lowercase, a wind from God. You can imagine a wind from God gives it almost a cosmic feel if it's an uppercase W. Some translations say the Spirit of God, Spirit of God, and with a lowercase s or an uppercase s. And what they're struggling with is what to do with this word ruach. And the Hebrew word ruach has a very interesting and broad range, somewhere between wind, spirit, and breath. Wind, spirit, and breath. So you can see how in the Hebrew there's an ambiguity there that is decided, that is determined, that is clarified, that is made less ambiguous by the translation decision. The Bible is full of choices of this kind. And what I want to leave you with as a characteristic to keep in mind is that the extent to which in the afterlife of Genesis interpreters saw the text as cryptic somehow, as enigmatic, not self-evident in terms of meaning, that characteristic is not only because of a distance from the text, not only because of a translation distance, and not only because of not knowing what words meant, forgetting that Tahom might have been evoking an image of Tiamat so as to say that the God that we worship is more powerful than those other gods, or that is the only God, right? By naturalizing the sun and moon god references in the neighborhood. But also that there is an extent to which ambiguity is invited for readers. The ambiguity of the text is preserved deliberately in some way. And I'll give you just a couple of examples and stop. One is this puzzling moment. It's quite beautiful in here where Jacob is renamed. He wrestles with an angel, it's not right here in this scene, but it's one of his nocturnal struggles. He wrestles with an angel, and the angel says, "No longer will you be called Jacob. Now you're going to be called Israel." And then right after that, he's Jacob again. And in that same moment where Jacob's renamed, the voice of God in that text renames, tells Jacob what God's name is. It says, "I am El Shaddai." And then we hear God again, not El Shaddai. And then Jacob sets up the sacred pillars at the site to memorialize it, and he calls it Beit El, where we get Bethel, Beit El, right? But it's the house of El, not the house of El Shaddai, which is the name of the God who had just identified itself to him. And that's odd. That's not just messiness. That's not just sloppy editing. That's not just a kind of a fetishistic attachment to traditions received, which is what a lot of 19th century critics suggested. It looks like a deliberate ambiguity. It looks like it's there, and it's left there to draw us into the text. In the same way that the Genesis 21, the Hagar story, in response to Abraham's query and plea for help, God says, "Listen to Sarah about everything that's going on with Hagar and her son," and then He doesn't ask his wife Sarah anything about her own son's fate in the very next chapter. And then right after that, she dies, right after the near sacrifice. Those tensions within the text seem to have been, they're left there at least. They could have been smoothed over. Some were smoothed over, but not all of them. Name changes, contradictory versions of enormously important moments, narratives that tell the story in very different ways. And the last one I'll leave you with is a fabulous moment when, in a series of tale types, versions of a particular type of scene, where a powerful man seizes a woman who's traveling with another man who's a stranger, right? And in order to save himself from being killed, so that he describes the woman who's with him, who is his wife, as his sister, right? This so-called wife-sister motif. It happens 3 times in Genesis. Many people have puzzled over it. There are many interesting aspects to it, but one particularly intriguing feature in that series of tales, especially in the third one, is the one where the powerful man who sees this woman and taken her to bed isn't able to engage in sex with her. Nevertheless, he has a troubling dream. And in the dream, the deity challenges him for what he's done, seizing this woman from this other man. And he says, in the dream, the powerful man protests to God in the dream, I haven't touched her. I have clean hands and a pure heart. And the deity responds, I know you have clean hands. Now, an ancient reader or listener to that text would have noticed a very sophisticated device that is simplistically called repetition in the Bible. It's not repetition. It's seeming repetition, but with subtle and very precise deviations from a repetition. So the man who is being accused in the dream of having done something terrible by seizing this woman protests to the deity, but I have clean hands and a pure heart. And the deity responds, I know you have clean hands. You know, in other words, you didn't touch her, but you don't have a clean heart, a pure heart. Right? It's left unsaid, but it's very clear. This sort of thing is found all over the Bible. And what we need to try to do is to train ourselves to be very, very careful readers, to notice these patterns. They're all over the text. Not so that we can fall back into a kind of figural box, seeing the text as hiding worlds and times other than our own, necessarily, but as a way of drawing our attention to the rich complexity of the text that is still there for us to see to some extent in English, much more so in Hebrew, that will give us a sense of the richness and the mystery that was produced over the course of many, many, many hundreds of years, and that is one of the reasons that the afterlife of it has been so rich.